and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
I'm blowing down this old dusty road. I'm blowing down this old dusty road. I'm blowing down this old dusty road. Lord, Lord, ain't gonna be treated this away. I'm going where the water tastes like wine. I'm going where the water tastes like wine. I'm going where the water tastes like wine. Lord, ain't gonna be treated this away. I'm looking for a job at honest pay. I'm a looking for a job at honest pay. I'm a looking for a job at honest pay. Lord, Lord, ain't gonna be treated this away. My children eat 3 square meals a day. Now my children eat 3 square meals a day. My children eat 3 square meals a day. Hey, Lord, ain't gonna be treated this away. Takes a $10 shoe to fit my feet. Your $2 shoe hurts my feet. Your $2 shoe hurts my feet. Lord, Lord, I ain't gonna be treated this away. I'm going down this old dusty road. I'm blowing down this old dusty road. I'm blowing down this old dusty road. Lord, Lord, I ain't gonna be treated this way. You know, I hadn't realized that was a Woody Guthrie song. That man was prolific. What a great example for any activist, any person for that matter. He lived what he believed. How many of us can say the same? I think it's important for each of us to be who we are. It's not as easy as it sounds. There's a lot of pressure on each of us to be someone else. The government wants us to be good little consumers that don't ask questions, work hard, and pay taxes. Companies want us to be good little workers that don't ask questions and work hard and pay taxes. Stores want us to be good little consumers. They don't care if we work hard, but they don't want us to ask questions, and they do want us to spend money. Need I go on? The pressures are immense. We're expected to put each other down so that we can get ahead. We're expected to be more interested in what we have and what we can get than whether our neighbors can eat or if they have a place to sleep. It's all about us. It's all about me. But here's an inspiration. You know what can be all about me? Being a better person and helping other people instead of hurting them. That's about me. And if you do that, we don't have to fight each other. We can get done by loving each other. We can get a lot more done by loving each other. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And we're here for your listening pleasure every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And we thank you for being here. We also thank Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com for putting us out there for you week after week. We hope you'll visit freedomslips.com and see what this fine internet radio network is all about. They're entirely listener supported. They could use your support. And now, I am proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome back special guests Michael Annis, Karen Kitkowski, Phil Ferruggio, and Steve Collett. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Mount Jackson, Denver, San Diego, and wherever you are. We continue here with our mini-series regarding A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America. It's a book. The culmination of all this is Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett and the False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio every Thursday. They are the evolved media, and we also seek to be so here, too. We know that today's newspapers, radio, TV are garbage, as well as the current version of what passes for alternative media, The Nation, The Progressive, NPR, Alternet, Rachel Maddow, Goodman, Jon Stewart, if not garbage, at least suspicious, very suspicious. But what we want to do is to say something in this miniseries here about the history of the alternative press, the beginnings that have evolved into Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett. More from the book. The incredible, creative, and chaotic period labeled the 1960s was not the American Revolution, though some of its activists thought it was, nor was it a coherent campaign against a simple target, though some rebels thought that unseating Lyndon Johnson would have the same liberating impact as bouncing King George. But it was an important rebellion against the accumulated rigidities of oppressive Puritanism, commercialized culture, corporate of passions with a multitude of forms, some violent, most not. Most of it was the work of a new generation sufficiently educated and informed to see intolerable conflicts within their society who chose not to go for those conflicts in Vietnam. Most of them had the boldness of Tom Paine and shared Paine's contempt for the authorities, but the centuries had made a difference. Like Tom Paine, the new dissidents began to speak in stark and impolite terms calculated to shake and enrage a smug and proper society. An early manifestation was appropriately called the Free Speech Movement. Thousands marched, made speeches, laid down the tracks of troop trains. Some threw stones, a few threw bombs. The authorities beat them, gassed them, infiltrated them, and sometimes, as we know now from official records, murdered them in cold blood. In a passion of liberation and anger, the protesters and rebels wrote, played music, and acted political dramas on stages, but they faced a problem Tom Paine did not. It was not hard for multiple editions of his revolutionary pamphlet, Common Sense. In Paine's time, most Americans lived in small towns and villages. A personal speech, a handbill posted in the tavern, a few dozen pamphlets reached most of the population. By 1960, things had changed. The population had increased from 4 million to 180 million. Small towns and villages were replaced by urban agglomerations and millions of people. You reached an audience through large, technologically complex and expensive systems of communication. Metropolitan newspapers, commercial broadcasting stations, national magazines, and Hollywood movies. Most of these systems carried standardized media pendant for novelty, creating events and sensations to break into the news. Too late, they found that it either corrupted them or placed them in the short half-life of all media sensations. Reporters and cameras turned away when the talk became serious. The alternative was to invent their own media, and they did. They learned how to print newspapers in ways that Goliath had never thought of. They published magazines that ran sophisticated investigation of corruption in high places. They learned how to make movies with handheld cameras and to project them on bedsheets. Eventually, they developed polished skills that produced political satires and documentaries that played in standard movie houses. The whole culture was held together by music, including records and tapes distributed nationally outside conventional commercial channels. The net result was the birth of a new family of American media, without which much of the message of the 1960s would have been lost. The 60s was the most creative decade we have yet experienced in this tragic century. Orthodox magazines, books, and movies, small and sometimes ephemeral creatures that live between the cracks of an economy dominated by giants. Next week, the Berkeley Barb. From A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America, continuing next week.
We interrupt this regularly scheduled something-something. This just into the New American Dream News Desk. 9 men have been arrested in Minneapolis, charged with trying to find an on-time Delta flight to join ISIS. The men are now in custody. FBI agents, however, found these posters and this job description flyer in the front seat of their red, yellow, and green clown car parked in the long-term parking area of the Minneapolis International Airport. See the world! Join ISIS! ISIS, a global force misunderstood. Not just a job, it's an adventure. ISIS Jihad Warrior creates havoc, kills, maims over wide area. More killing, some more maiming, a little more havoc here, some more over here. Must have to keep things or be able to learn. Must be able to work long hours, sleep a little bit, then work long hours again, like that. Previous acting experience, a plus. Sign making. Shouting. Travel is required. Should work well with others up to a point. Jeep driver certification helpful. Looting and pillaging training a plus. Map skills also a plus. The successful candidate will be able to demonstrate on-camera fake beheading skills. Computer literacy, Photoshop also a plus. Mossad or CIA training, a requirement, will be provided. Raggedy-ass uniforms, big long guns, fake beards also provided. ISIS does not discriminate on the pillaging, rampaging, wage commensurate with experience, PTO accrued 8 hours per month of successful pillaging, 1 week paid vacation if live for the first year, to set up an interview, contact United States Senator John McCain, U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. And now the New American Dream Real History Channel, sponsored by Artifact Ripped Up Jeans. They really look really, really, really old. We continue with letters from Father Larry Rosebaugh from El Salvador, 1986. In my first letter to you, I took some time explaining how I got to El Salvador, how my past year in Mexico helped prepare the way for the work to be done here. Many in positions of authority have a way of devaluing the life and person of the poor, characterizing the oppressed as lazy, criminal, without intellectual capacity or the desire to work. We who live among the marginalized must be the voice for our friends whose right to express themselves is denied them. If I can share the portion of the life of friends here, these letters to you will have fulfilled their purpose. Benjamin is a man, 57 years of age, whose hair is black without a sign of graying. He's worked in the campo since he was 7. This is more the custom than the exception, as the knowledge of the land and how to tend it is one's means of survival. The campesino family rises at 4 in the morning or earlier. The fire is started and the coffee readied. Tortillas are put over the hot coals, and tamales containing corn and sugar or a sample of meat are also on hand. And finally, breakfast is served. While the food is being prepared, Benjamin is busy sharpening what to us appears to be a hand sickle. In Spanish, they're called kumas. And without the kuma and the machete, the campesino would be lost. The land that Benjamin and other campesinos work is on the hillside, very rocky and generally dry. Only one who has been born on this land could till it with any measure of success. It is here that the kuma is used as a spade, a hoe, a sickle, a rake, all in one. Within 3 weeks after sowing the seeds, the hillside will be green with sturdy small stalks of corn. As Christmas grows near the majority of the Christmas crop, early each morning, trucks come by to take the people 30 or 40 kilometers to work. Entire families of men, women, and children often work the harvest together. Though the pay is minimal, it provides funds for food, school needs, and other necessities. Benjamin is mature and his faith unfaltering. Years ago, he began to offer his assistance to the parish priest. As handyman, his skills and visions reach out in all directions. He was here the morning I arrived, preparing the altar, adjusting the microphone, and calling the people far and near to participate in the liturgy. We see a sort of mutual commitment to each other. In the mornings, I try to work on the fields with him, and he keeps close by to attend, to respond to the needs of the parish, which are many. Benjamin, as other campesinos, is a person with tremendous energy and physical strength. His disciplined life has hewed him into a person of faith and vision, accompanied by an endurance to live with a multitude of obstacles and hardships. So together we work in the fields, visit the villages close by, and little by little share ideas with the people. So together we work in the fields, visit the villages close by, and little by little share ideas with the people.
This has been the New American Dream Real History Channel, sponsored by Artifact Ripped Up Jeans. They look really, really cool because they look really, really old. This spot, the first guest, the fourth Thursday of the month, 5:15 p.m. Central Time, is reserved for Steve Collett. Steve passed away on April 2nd. This is the obituary for Steve from the L.A. Times. Steve Collett dies at 76. San Diego poet championed numerous causes. To Steve Collett, the biggest sins that could be committed by poetry were being dull, obscure, too laden with illusions that might woo the intellectuals but turn off the common man and woman. His poem, "I Attend a Poetry Reading," is Collett's send-up of much of modern poetry and modern poets. Polite applause had stiffened to an icy silence. No one clapped or nodded. No one sighed. As a poet, essayist, teacher, and self-described all-around no-good troublemaker, Collett was never dull. In a dozen volumes of poetry, his enthusiasm burst off the page in language that was direct, accessible, and devoid of the ambiguity favored by some literary critics. His poetic models included Walt Whitman, Robinson, Jeffers, and Allen Ginsberg, and he admitted in an essay titled "The Mystique of the Difficult Poem" that try as he might, he could not fathom poems such as those of Hart Crane and others that were filled with footnotable literary allusions and hopelessly gnarled syntax and untrackable metaphoric acrobats. Recently retired from Southwestern College in Chula Vista, but still holding poetry workshops at Liberty Station in San Diego, Collett died April 2nd of cardiac arrest at his home in Potrero in a rural stretch of southern San Diego County near the border with Mexico. He was 76. He died just days before his last volume of poetry is set to be published by Tampa University Press. A story in the Times once described Collett as a pro, bard of innumerable liberal causes, a teacher, elfin, self-mocking, editor of a sassy volume of the No Intellectuals Need Apply poetry called The Maverick Poets. Among his causes in poetry and prose were animal rights and the plight of immigrants. Steve Mark Collett was born June 3, 1938, in New York. He liked to say that he was Jewish by birth, Buddhist by inclination. He served in the Army Reserves and attended Brooklyn College. In New York, he was part of the Lower East Side poetry reading scene in the early 1960s. Later, attracted by the intellectual freedom accentuated by the beat poets, he moved to San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury and received a master's degree from then San Francisco State College. He taught at San Diego State, San Diego City College, UC San Diego, and the College of Southern Idaho, and was publisher of Guerrilla Press and founder of the Animal Rights Coalition of California. Among his books was In the Palm of Your Hand, A Poet's Portable Workshop, a lively and illuminating guide for the practicing poet. His poetry was read by Garrison Keillor on his national radio show. Part of Collett's reputation among poets and poetry lovers came from poetry readings. He was a terrific performer, said poet and artist Austin Strauss. He could have been an actor. When he was on stage, he was mesmerizing. He used humor to talk about matters of life and death. Collett is survived by his wife, Mary, and his sister, Carol Adler. A poetry reading in his honor is set for April 26th at Liberty Station, sponsored by San Diego Writers, Inc.
And now I would like to read one of Steve's poems. This is entitled Last Will. If I am ever unlucky enough to die, God forbid, I would like to be propped up in my orange overstuffed chair with my legs crossed, dressed in a cashmere sweater and jeans, and embalmed in a permanent glaze like a donut or linen, a small bronze plaque on the door of my study showing the dates of my incarnation and death, and leave the room as it was. Let nothing be touched in the house. My underpants stuck on the doorknob just where I left them. My dental floss lying on top of the Bhagavad Gita next to my socks. Let the whole of Ebers Street be roped off and planted with yews from Narragansett to Cape May and left as a monument to my passing. The street? No, the city itself. Henceforth, let it be known as the Steve M. Cowett Memorial Park and Museum. Better yet, if the thing can be done without too much fuss, put the whole planet to sleep. Let the pigeons and buses and lawyers and ladies hanging out wash freeze in their tracks. Let the whole thing be preserved under ice, just as it looked when the last bit of drool trickled over my chin. Let the last of the galaxies sizzle out like a match in the wind, and the cosmic balloon shrink down to a noodle and screech to a halt. Let time clot like a pinprick of blood, and the great solar flame flicker down to the size of a Yurtzit candle, leaving the universe dark, but for one tiny spotlight, trained on the figure of me, propped in my chair. For after my death, what possible reason could life in any form care to exist? Don't you see it would be utterly pointless? I would be gone. Look, try to conceive it a world without me. Me entirely absent. Nobody here with these eyes, this name, these teeth. Nothing but vacant space. A dry, sucking wind where I walked, where I sat, where you used to see me, you would see nothing at all. I tell you, it dwarfs the imagination. Oh, yes, one last thing. The right leg is to be crossed over the left. I prefer it that way. Prop the left elbow up on the arm of the chair, with a pen in my right hand. Let my left be characteristically scratching my skull or pulling my hair. If you wish, close the lids of my eyes, but whatever you do, the mouth must remain open, just as it was in life. Yes, open forever. On that, I absolutely insist.
This poem is entitled Lurid Confessions by Steve Cowett. One fine morning, they move in for the pinch and snap on the cuffs, just like that. Turns out they've known all about you for years. Have a file the length of a paddy wagon with everything. Tapes, prints, film, the whole schmear. Don't ask me how, but they've managed to plug a mic into one of your molars and know every felonious move and transgression back to the very beginning with ectochromes of your least indiscretion in peccadillo. Needless to say, you are thrilled. Though sitting there in the docket, you bogarted, tough as an old tooth, your jaw set, your leaves rolled in 3 days of stubble. Only when they play it back, it looks different. A life common and loathsome as gum stuck to a chair. Tedious hours of you picking your nose, scratching, eating, clipping your toenails. Alone, you look stupid. In public, your rapier wit is slimy and limp as an old Band-Aid. They have thousands of pictures of people around you stifling yawns. As for sex, a bit of pathetic groping among the unlovely and luckless, and a dance with everyone making steamy love in the dark, and you alone in a corner eating a pretzel. You leap to your feet protesting. That's not how it was. They have it all wrong. But nobody hears you. The bailiff is snoring, The judge is cleaning his teeth. The jurors are all wearing glasses with eyes painted open. The flies have folded their wings and stopped buzzing. In the end, after huge doses of cough,
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning.
We are far stronger than we were 10 weeks ago.
General Quarters, all hands man your battle station.
Be nervous about your toes. I'll do the
mastermind
around here.
You who have not seen it do not know what hell looks like from the top.
Bam, check it out every Tuesday and Saturday on Revolution Radio. It's a double dose of the internationally recognized renegade military historian, Douglas Dietrich.
You'll stay right where you are until I tell you to move out.
Yeah, that's right. Tuesdays from 10 to midnight Eastern Time, join Douglas Dietrich as he exposes the truth in hidden history on his show, Critical Omissions. And then our human weapon of mass destruction is back once again to take your calls on Saturday night firing lines, both from 10 to 12 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And now, Andrei Vilcek, philosopher, novelist, filmmaker, investigative journalist, poet, playwright, and photographer. Andrei Vilcek is a revolutionary internationalist and a globetrotter who fights against Western imperialism and the Western regime imposed on the world. He covered dozens of war zones and conflicts from Iraq and Peru to Sri Lanka, Bosnia, Rwanda, Syria, Congo, and Timor-Leste. His latest books are Fighting Against Western Imperialism and On Western Terrorism with Noam Chomsky. In today's world, everything is upside down. Brothers fear brothers. Guerrilla fighters are made to spy on each other. And heroes who are fighting for survival of the planet are labeled by Western regimes as demagogues, strongmen, or even terrorists. The empire successfully mobilized the most regressive elements in each society that it controls. It upheld religions, archaic family compositions, and feudalist power structures in order to make rebellion almost impossible. Albert Camus, a French philosopher, once one of the most important statists of the 20th century when he declared, "I rebel, therefore I exist." Rebellion is the engine that propels societies and individuals forward. To take it away, to shut it off, means to condemn people and entire nations to stagnation, even to regression, which is, of course, the main goal of the empire, which is why it employs and grooms entire armies of local collaborators.
The empire created some amazing sights all over the world. Depressing, gore-filled scenes. For much of the planet, it is Halloween every day and every night. The West has many allies, many collaborators, bizarre bearded dudes with machine guns and portable missile launchers, decapitating infidels and blowing up the World Heritage Sites. This is what the Empire has been trying painstakingly to turn Islam into, with full-hearted support of its deranged and blood-drenched allies in the Gulf. First, they murdered, sidelined, or overthrew progressive socialist Islamic leaders. And later they manufactured the most fundamentalist brands from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. Bravo. Great success. As long as the oil flows, as long as the Western weapons are sold and defense budgets remain above $1 trillion, as long as there's always someone people can be told to be scared of, someone who can be used as a justification for new weaponry and new post-colonialist and imperialist arrangement of the world. Or look at those weird preachers and priests in Surabaya, Manila, or in Uganda in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Poor are poor because God hates them. Rich are rich because God loves them, I heard the other day in Indonesia, filming one large Christian gathering that was taking place in a mall. Pentecostal implants from the West. Prosperity gospel. Evangelicals. Fanatics resembling the Inquisition era bigots. There's an entire panoptic of monstrous Christian freaks available in the client states. If destabilizing China is the main goal, of course, they're always there and ready. Ukraine, Uganda, Indonesia, Egypt, Oceania, no problem. Always ready, always there, always handy.
Would visit our planet, the visitors would surely be horrified by observing those individuals who are ruling such countries as Indonesia or Uganda or those in the Gulf. They would most likely ask, what kind of empire is it that is employing such vile butlers and servants? Nobody is laughing or puking only because all of us, even the most outspoken critics of the regime, were already somehow conditioned. We are all behaving and to some extent playing the game. None of us starts rolling on the floor in total amusement, pointing fingers at the television screen that is showing dozens of former Indonesian generals and officers responsible for genocides of 1965 or those in East Timor or Papua now holding some of the highest positions in their land. Nobody is throwing up when the UN Secretary General of the United Nations flies to Kampala or Kigali and begs countries responsible for genocide of millions of innocent people in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, according to his own UN staff, which produced several detailed reports on the subject, please not to withdraw their peacekeeping forces operating and getting royally paid from their missions all over Africa. Nobody is fuming and drawing political cartoons depicting the most horrific nature of the Saudi regime and its arch henchmen who are giving orders to blast Yemen, killing hundreds and most likely thousands of innocent people simply because they are Shia and because they are demanding social justice. No Hollywood horror film could match the monsters that are ruling many corners of the globe, controlling, raping, robbing, and brainwashing their own people on behalf of the empire.
How many of those cars, those Ferraris and the latest BMWs, in some miserable country that is being fully plundered by Western mining and oil companies, are running on gas? And how many on blood? How many magazines, newspapers, and television stations in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, or East and West Africa are actually there to inform people? How many are serving dutifully the propaganda apparatus of the empire? The level of collaboration with the West is scandalous. It is shocking. The most notorious forms of collaboration and spite towards the people can be found in what I lately call the Belt, which consists of the client states and semi-colonies spreading from Southeast Asia to East and West Africa, with the subcontinent and the Middle East in between. In that part of the world, countries that refused to collaborate, Indonesia before 1965, Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Syria, Somalia, Congo under Patrice Lumumba, to name just a few, were muzzled, raped, destroyed, annihilated, and leveled with the ground. In that belt, there is no shame left and no dignity. Intellectual cowardice, repulsive egoism, and servility in the countries like Malaysia or Indonesia are beyond obscene. They are grotesque, perverse, almost entire, pathetically shallow art establishments in Jakarta and Kuala Lumpur are living from the Western handouts, from so-called funding. Artists and intellectuals say and write and film what is expected of them, what the West pays them to produce, and then, of course, what sells.
In the meantime, corporate gangsters are plundering land with absolutely no obstacles, murdering indigenous people if they cross their way, and then build their palaces abroad from the booty, all in plain daylight with no...
Mike, I'm not sure exactly where we lost you.
Chuck, did I get dropped again?
I'm going to... Yes, you
Chuck?
Did.
Okay, well... Should we just keep going?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, I'm not sure either where it dropped when I was going, but if you could just go to...
All right, well, let me pick
up. What about the other side?
And what about the other side? As horrible as were those individuals mentioned above, people who resisted and fought for freedom of mankind were some of the greatest human beings of the 20th century, which did not spare many of them from being murdered and then smeared by the empire and its lackeys. Many of them were aided by the Soviet Union and China in their efforts to break shackles of their people. Nasser of Egypt, Patrice Lumumba of Congo, Julius Nyerere of Tanzania, Ernesto Che Guevara of Argentina, Salvador Allende Gossens of Chile, Dilma Vana Rousseff of Brazil, Nelson Mandela of South Africa, Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua, Evo Morales of Bolivia, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, Ho Chi Minh of Vietnam, Mao Zedong of China, Fidel Castro of Cuba, Mossadegh of Iran. To compare two lists would, if one were really willing to see and to compare, destroy all remaining illusions about the West supporting and aiding democracy. For years, decades, and centuries, the West was actually aiding the most extreme to the right-wing military, to religious zealots and feudal family and power structures, is actually something that is visible and easily detectable, at least if one wants.
Meaning enormous and complex groups, or call it Chuck?
Yes.
Hello, Chuck. Hello, Chuck. I just was wondering if we're still here.
Can you hear me, Mike?
I was going.
Yeah.
I can, but it does drop out, and. You know what I would suggest is that this is a great article by Andre Vilcek, and it gives us a lot of insight into how things are going in the third world, because Andre has been there, and maybe we could do it better justice at another time, and maybe we could go to Karen. I'll read a little bit of Karen's introduction, but if she goes ahead and answers, I'll just be quiet.
Sounds good, Mike. Thank you.
Karen Kotowski is an American activist and commentator. She is a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel whose assignments include duties as a Pentagon desk officer and a variety of roles for the National Security Agency. Since retiring, she has become a noted critic of the U.S. government's involvement in Iraq Kitkowski is primarily known for insider essays which denounce a corrupting political influence on the course of military intelligence leading up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. In 2012, she challenged incumbent Bob Goodlatte in the Republican primary for Virginia's 6th Congressional District seat in the United States House of Representatives and garnered 34% of the Republican vote on a constitutional and limited government platform. She speaks to us from Mount Jackson, Virginia.
Hello,
Karen. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. You are on the air.
Okay.
Let me warn you ahead of time that we're having some technical problems tonight, so if you hear a dropout or something, that's why. Just keep trying.
Okay, I'll do that. Yeah, well, it's great to be here, and I have a couple things on my mind, and I was trying to figure out which one I wanted to talk about first, but I'll start out with a simple one. And I don't know if people know, but I teach a couple of online classes, and I make all the students, and I teach, because I'm teaching online, I'm teaching adult learners and also younger students, so there's a whole range of demographics that you have, age demographics, really. And, of course, and this is not something just I notice, but this is something almost everybody notices who does this, the older people, I say older people, 40s, 50s, 60s, those kinds of, that age, these students actually know how to make sentences. They know how to write paragraphs. They know how to communicate in writing. They know how to proofread. They know how to spell. This is shocking, but they know how to spell. And that's, it's great. And the younger people under 30 really, every once in a while, you know, maybe 10% of the time, you have students that can write up. They're young and they can write, and they take their time, and they it's clear that they're doing a lot of reading because they know how to write. Because writing and reading, you know, is very closely connected. You read, you read, you read when you write, and you read what you've written. You want to, anyway. 90% of those kids under 30, or students.
If anybody's out there, we've been having technical difficulties with the radio show, with our internet, and please stick around. We're trying to resolve the issues. And once again, we really do apologize. We haven't had this many technical difficulties with the show in probably about a year. Very frustrating for us. I'm sure it is for our listeners as well. But we're trying with our backup plan here, and we'll see how it goes.
Hello? Yeah, I don't know. I ended up losing the station as well. I'd already had problems with Mike several times, so I'm hoping that if I reboot, it's going to solve things. I don't know. Yeah,
got an empty box.
Would you like another?
Extra big ass fries.
I said I didn't get any.
Thank you. Your account has been charged. Your balance is zero. Please
what?
Come back when you can afford to make a purchase.
No, no.
I'm sorry you're
having
trouble.
Come on.
I'm
My kids are starving.
Thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio. Here at Revolution Radio, we believe in freedom of ideas, freedom of speech, but above all, we believe in freedom of existence through self-reliance. This station is 100% listener-supported, and as a fundraising promotion, I have a kick-ass free gift for a $100 donation. 35,000 seeds. 25 years in the freezer, long-term storable, 54 different varieties. So if food prices go crazy, the shit hits the fan, or you just want to save tons of money every year by creating your own food like I do, grab our seed pack special. Just look for the banner on the homepage at freedomslips.com. Don't be a statistic. Don't be part of the problem. Be part of the solution. We need, as humans, to start taking care of ourselves and not depending on the megacorps to provide unhealthy, nasty food. Included in this package is also a DVD with 900 survival and off-grid living documents and the offline home canning how to do everything website all on the DVD. So when you're growing all that food, you know how to can it, store it, preserve it, etc. with all these documents. So thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I hope that you will pick up this package and start learning to be free. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps and freedom is one seed that needs to be planted.
What are we doing live? It goes in eternity.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, hello, everyone. We're still encountering some technical difficulties. Right now, we're trying to pull up the Phil Ferruccio segment. But, Mike, it might be good if you just go ahead and proceed with the next part first.
I'm Madison, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earthers news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polacek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. From citizensforlegitimategovernment.org, UN torture expert refused access to Guantanamo Bay and U.S. federal prisons. The United Nations top investigator on the use of torture has accused Washington of dragging its feet over his requested visits to prisons and refusing to give him access to inmates at Guantanamo. Juan Mendez said he had been waiting for more than 2 years for the United States to provide him access to a range of state and federal prisons where he wants to probe the use of solitary confinement. Mendez told reporters in Geneva he wanted to visit federal prisons in New York and Colorado and state prisons in New York, California, Louisiana, among others. Putin in film on Crimea, U.S. masterminds are behind Ukraine coup, helped train radicals. They facilitated the armed coup. The Ukrainian armed coup was organized from Washington, Russian President Vladimir Putin stated in an interview for a new documentary aired last Sunday. The Americans tried to hide behind the Europeans, but Moscow saw through the trick. He added, the trick of the situation was that outwardly the Ukrainian opposition was supported mostly by the Europeans, but we knew for sure that the real masterminds were our American friends, Putin said in a documentary, Crimea, the Way Home, aired by Russia One News Channel. They helped training the nationalists, their armed groups in Western Ukraine, in Poland, and to some extent in Lithuania, he added. Maduro wins decree powers to fight U.S. imperialism.
Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro was given the right to rule by decree for 9 months as he continued to capitalize on the backlash created by recent U.S. sanctions. In a raucous session full of chanting and blistering speeches, the National Assembly, which is controlled by the ruling party, passed the Anti-Imperialist Enabling Law for Peace. Four Blackwater guards sentenced in Iraq shootings of 31 unarmed civilians. A federal judge in Washington handed down prison terms of 30 years to life behind bars to four Blackwater worldwide guards convicted in a deadly 2007 shooting that killed 14 unarmed Iraqis and injured others in a Baghdad traffic circle. U.S. District Judge Roy C. Lambert sentenced Nicholas A. Slatin of Sparta, Tennessee, to life in prison. Slatin is the only of the four guards convicted of murder in the incident in which American security contractors fired assault rifles and grenades into halted noonday traffic, a low point of the U.S. war in Iraq that sent relations between the two countries into a crisis. 10 deputies placed on leave after arrest beating video. A Southern California sheriff has placed 10 deputies on paid administrative leave after news video recorded a violent arrest that he says appeared to be excessive force. San Bernardino County Sheriff John McMahon announced the action Friday in the aftermath of the arrest of 30-year-old Francis Pusak, CBS Los Angeles reported. Cornel West sparks shutdown 814 movement. Dr. Cornel West has called for people across America to participate in a national movement to put a stop to the killing of Black and Latino people. Dr. West's call to action is trending on social media under the hashtag #ShutdownA14, with supporters and participants of the movement using the expression to speak out on the injustice of police brutality. According to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, Shutdown 814 is meant to disrupt business as usual. People are encouraged to flood public offices, buildings, and spaces in the name of justice. Chuck, how are we doing? Any luck with...
I should be able to play the Michael's bit. And then maybe we can do Phil's at the top of the next hour. If you could just fill in up until it's time for Michael's now, please.
Okay, I'm going to read, Chuck, I'm going to read Michael's introduction, and maybe you'll be ready to go by then. Michael Annis founded Howling Dog Press on money from the Change Jar in 1981. He was fervently pissed about the powers that be then. With years added on to his work at Howling Dog, he is presently frenetically livid about this toxic trauma we call a free nation governed by a free people. Where are the real poets, he ponders, the ones with something to say and unafraid to say it? Graduating from an MFA program doesn't automatically equate to a force for the empowerment of language and culture. In fact, it quite often unfolds the polar opposite. He says, if you're thinking of leaving a footprint, leave it in language. Leave it within the locus of the psyche, where all revolution ultimately manifests. But if you're planning on using an MFA program to show you how to go about it, time now to hang up your keyboard back in the closet. He often reflects on the notion that most perception is a slave of belief, and the language commonly generated in this paradigm is language chained to superstition and ignorance. He believes his mission is to destroy the chains that enforce this imprisonment. Again, Michael Annis, and he spoke to Chuck earlier in the week, and Michael is the editor of Howling Dog Press. He's also a poet. He's also a member on the staff of Churn magazine out of L.A., and Michael speaks to us from Denver.
Okay, we're going to try. Tonight, we welcome once again Michael Annis from Denver, Colorado, the editor of Howling Dog Press, and... well, he has many other things going. Michael, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Chuck. Good to be back again. I'm going to start off reading Brave New World Order, Part 9. We left off last month with Part 8, obviously. And the first thing I have for you is a quote, which begins Brave New World Order, Part 9. As long as a man knows very well the strength and weaknesses of his teaching, his art, his religion, its power is still slight. The pupil and apostle who, blinded by the authority of the master and by the piety he feels toward him, pays no attention to the weaknesses of a teaching, a religion, and soon usually has for that reason more power than the master. The influence of a man has never yet grown great without his blind pupils. To help a perception to achieve victory often means merely to unite it with stupidity so intimately that the weight of the latter also enforces the victory of the former. Friedrich Nietzsche. Brave New World Order, Part 9. Pharmacopoeia. Like drugs masking the symptoms of disease but doing nothing to cure or resolve it, the myriad superstitions, formal and informal, about this supreme being, this God, this Godhead, masked in the face of the biological creature who called itself human, concealed and distorted the truth of the universe and of existence. While the wheel of Maya churned endlessly and bright young eyes glazed over old and dim, and the generations rose and withered like grass, the prophets, poets, and philosophers of each incarnation were all saying the same thing, all perceiving the same thing, which was, my God, I can't die in this. If this is all that there is, then I am as nothing. What fate more horrible could there ever be? Out of fear, born of ignorance, each generation in its turn began its futile, pain-filled crawling beneath the superstitious religious rigors and laws of I am, who was, is, and shall be eternally. When confronted with the sorrows of the perennially disinherited, incarnation after incarnation, the rationales and justifications rolled out such as this. I believe they must be lacking in something vital to self-preservation, antithetical to self-determination, and that's spelled F-A-I-T-H, and that means A-M-B-I-T-I-O-N, ambition, which is an active principle and not a passive one. They are just downright lazy. It's just common sense. The way of sloth, of the fool and the dullard, is reactionary to the ways of God. For God is a God of action, of belief in greater things to manifest, whether through the individual or the community. Those outside the body of believers will reap what they have sown. They need to think positive, to be creative with the problems at hand, to turn all things over to a higher power while keeping their noses to the grindstone. In fact, if examined closely, and with deeper understanding of human character that is disenfranchised from the will of God, it all resolves itself in a pariah mentality, blood-sucking the system, expecting welfare and handouts. Besides, who knows? The Lord hasn't placed us, neither we ourselves, in the position to suffer. Suffering is for another world, a distant third world, a world devoid of the riches that come through being a faithful and humble servant of the one true way. If it were truly a problem for those of the one true way, a problem with universality at its heart, would not we also suffer along with them? Besides, who knows? Perhaps they chose their lot in life. Perhaps they have subconsciously wed rebellion. Perhaps they fire their fate. And etc. Get them locked into religious wars, then overlord flunkies and puppets can skim off the riches floating on the top of their seas of blood. Fill them with superstition, such as God's double judgment, twice judged, once on earth, where such monumental suffering would infest their lives, it left them with nothing but agonized bitterness and despair, which eliminated any possibility to repent before Judgment Day. It couldn't even become a rational consideration, what with their heads reeling and spinning in the vortex of pain and shame. And a second time judged, when on the Day of Judgment, it was established that they had not repented during their life on earth. there had never been a generation inhabiting the earth that had not attempted seeing the face of God by any other means than defining it and speaking of it through their own place, time, mentality, and circumstance, and often superciliously or condescendingly so. And this presented the conundrum of being unable to realize and understand the infinite truth from the disadvantaged point in space and time of being locked in the prison of their own misunderstanding of their own here and now. End of part 9.
Well, that continuing series is really fascinating, Michael. I really appreciate your bringing it to our show.
Well, thanks a lot, Chuck. And but you know, it's difficult to go actually to go on the air and to read or perform a work like this, because this work is so often contrary to, you know, the common thinking, the common perceptions. And I'm not saying that this is somehow superior. I'm just saying that because it is different, because it is something that avoids the atypical way of looking at things, particularly in the religious sense, you know, it can stir up a lot of negative reactions. So I guess what I'm saying is that I appreciate the New American Dream allowing me to continue with this in the way I have been. And all I can tell you is that there is a turning and a turning point where it starts to resolve itself, starts to bring in new ideas about perception and existence here.
Well, I look forward to that.
I do too, because this is not easy. Believe me.
Do you, Michael, have you performed this in person for audiences?
Oh my God. I really have. I've performed certain sections of it. There's a section coming up that's devoted to human devotion to war as a resolution to problems. And I have performed that several times. In fact, I did at one point in time with Mike, when Mike and I were Palachek, when we were performing together, you know, and he was touring with his Looking for Bigfoot book. Yeah. So, that's much more poetic than what I've been reading at the beginning. It doesn't, the language often turns in this piece. It's a very long piece, and the language often turns to purely poetic language and away from more of the interstitial nonfiction. So,
well,
you got a copy of Churn?
That's right. I was just going to say, I am looking at this beautiful magazine called Churn, and this one is volume 2, number 2, and it is quite fascinating. I really like the way that that you set off your piece, that the part 1 of Brave New World Order in this magazine, the art of David Alan Reed, just really sets it off beautifully.
Yeah, he's true. He's a really a young genius. He's I think somewhere in his early 30s. Guy is doing amazing work. Yeah, we're going to continue working together on this and a couple other projects as well.
Well, that's good.
Then there are, four other authors in there, four other writers, and
And a plethora of artists and photographers.
Right, right. Yeah. So I have a, I asked the publisher if he'd like to make a, some kind of a statement about what CHERN is all about and why it exists, and he gave me a short statement. Can I read it?
Absolutely. Please do.
All right. This is from Jeff Manji, who is the CEO and publisher of this magazine. Let me get it up here. And he says, if you can let them know that the vision of the magazine, its main purpose, is to keep the arts alive by co-creating and sharing new ideas, art forms, whether they be paint on canvas, experimental music, writers, fashion, or whatever, they are still valid and needed. Hang on a second. And still valid and needed in today's hustle and bustle. CHERN offers another perspective. Art can change minds. Thus has the real potential to change a piece of our shared experience as human and human history. Artists add purpose and color to a world gone mad. And oftentimes, this is my own editing on that, and oftentimes certainly echo and reinforce and amplify a world gone mad. And what that does is it brings the problems to the fore and causes us to pause, say, what can we do about to change, you know, to change this? And I think that one of the most important things, at least regarding CHERN, and what we're doing there is that you, when you bring to bear a focus on issues, whether they're positive or negative, and shed light upon them in a creative new way, what you're going to do, hopefully, is get new responses and new ways of dealing with those issues and problems. So that would be my own addition to it, editorial addition. That's what we're doing with the literature. That's what we're doing with the art.
Well, all I can say is that the result is stunning.
Well, thank you.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, but I've really enjoyed visiting with you, and we will look forward to seeing you again next month.
And I look forward to it, too, as always. Great program. And by the way, very, very sad news about Steve Collett.
Oh, wasn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks, Michael Ennis, for that interview recorded earlier with him earlier today. And I would like to apologize to Phil Ferruccio, whose segment didn't get on at all, and to Karen Kutkowski, who was cut off in the middle of her phone call. And we will try to do better next time. We think we have things resolved, and we hope you'll stay tuned for our final segment, which should go just fine.
Famous last words, Chuck.
I know it, Mike.
Well, we are going to do the absolute best we can, and I appreciate all the work you do with the technical, and I don't have to do any of that because I can't, and you can, but tonight was just a rough night, and that's just the way it goes sometimes. Next segment, we're going to hope we get in. We're going to get the news from Duluth. We're going to get some news from the Wisconsin Daytime Drama Series from the Wisconsin Arts Council, if we can contact those folks. And we're just gonna hold our breath and cross our fingers and hope it all goes well. How's things? We've got another minute here. We can talk about the weather, Chuck. What's the weather like in Florida?
Well, we have
We've had some storms recently, but it's mostly very nice summery sort of weather. Well, there we go.
Very nice. Okay. we're supposed to have snow tomorrow in Minnesota. So, okay, here we go. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. All we need is a 10 and a fiver, car and keys and a sober driver. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. We now join in progress another episode of the Wisconsin Daytime Drama Series sponsored by the Wisconsin Arts Council, hoping you will contribute to their most recent fundraising attempt to get green and gold, the recognition they deserve on the state flag, as well as designated summertime vestments for the Wisconsin Catholic Archdiocese of Green Bay. And now we bring you straight out of Kenosha. We find Curly talking to Hal the bartender during happy hour at American Legion Post 99. Hal is just now refilling the plastic peanut bowl.
Sweat, Hal.
You got it coming right up, Curly.
You know, Hal.
What's that, Curly?
I decided to move back to my hometown and saw the creeping and creepy way the lives of my working class family members, my neighborhood, and my community had been devalued and degraded by the forces against which left-leaning people have always railed, the same forces my family and town so solidly backed in the voting booths.
You got that right, Curly. Here you go.
Thanks. My part of town, the North End, contains the most hardcore of the town's working class neighborhoods, where you're more likely to find the 20,000 a year laborer and the 14,000 a year fast food worker. I grew up here. My dad worked at a gas station here, and my mom worked at a since demolished textile mill, whose rattling looms were the round-the-clock backdrop of our lives. I smoked my first cigarette here, married a poor white girl from down the street. My forebears are buried here. All my ghosts are here. The ghosts of 250 years of ancestors. The ghosts of old love affairs. The ghosts of my youth. I know everyone's last name. Whose daddy was show and who boinked whom when we were in high school. When I moved back after 30 years, it was as if my heart was back where it belonged. Well, which lasted about 3 months. It didn't take too many visits to the old neighborhood tavern or to the shabby church I attended as a child to discover that here in this neighborhood, in the richest nation on earth, folks are having a hard go of it. And it's getting harder. 2 in 5 residents of the North End do not have a high school diploma. Here, nearly everyone over 50 has serious health problems. Credit ratings rarely top 500. And alcohol, Jesus, and overeating are the three preferred venues of escape. These days, the neighborhood looks as if it was painted by Edward Hopper, then bleakly populated with gangsters, old men, 40-ounce malt liquor hot bottles, hardworking single moms and kids on cheap, busted plastic tricycles. Their needs, affordable health care, a living wage, steady employment, affordable rents, having some money for retirement, differ from those of all working-class Americans only in degree. There's no sharp dividing line between the working poor renters in this neighborhood and the working class homeowners in the treeless, T-board-sized modular home suburbs here and everywhere else. The working class here in what they are now calling the heartland exists on a continuum, ranging from complete insecurity to the not quite complete insecurity of having a decent but endangered job. It's a continuum extending from the apathy of the poorest to the hard-edged anger of those with more to lose. which ain't a lot, brother, when your household income hovers around $30,000 or $35,000 with both people working. Many are working poor but kid themselves they're middle class, partly out of pride, partly because of the long-running national lie that most Americans are middle class. Being born lower class and working America makes some of us, probably most of us, class conscious for life. Consequently, most of what I ever talk about is class in America, especially the class from which I sprang, the bottom third of Americans constituting the unacknowledged working class poor. Conservative, politically misinformed or oblivious, and patriotic to their own detriment. One more. Then I got to go water my effing zinnias, Hal.
You got it, Curly. Join us next week for another Wisconsin daytime drama, straight out of Kenosha, sponsored by Cheesehead Earbuds, Beverly's Big Bratwurst, and Lake Wissota Mulch Beer. And now please join us as we join In Progress, a National Press Club Hall of Fame presentation with our guests, Philip Berrigan, Thomas Merton, Marilyn Buck, Daniel Berrigan, George Jackson, and Hunter S. Thompson. Now making his way to the podium, Thomas Merton.
Do not depend on the hope of results. You may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and even achieve no results at all, if not perhaps results opposite to what you expect. As you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the rightness, the truth of the work itself. You gradually struggle less and less for an idea and more for specific people. In the end, it is the reality of personal relationship that saves everything. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything, is to succumb to the violence of our times. Only the man who has had to face despair is really convinced that he needs mercy. Those who do not want mercy never seek it. It is better to find God on the threshold of despair than to risk our lives in a complacency that has never felt the need of forgiveness. A life that is without problems may literally be more hopeless than one that always verges on despair. The logic of worldly success rests on a fallacy, the strange error that our perfection depends on the thoughts and opinions and applause of other men. A weird life it is indeed to be living always in somebody else's imagination, as if that were the only place in which one could at last become real. The greatest need of our time is to clean out the enormous mass of mental and emotional rubbish that clutters our minds. What we have to be is what we are.
And now Marilyn Buck. In Peru, a demonstration against a rise in bread prices is stopped because of threats to denounce those who demand bread as terrorists. How greatly we fear language, an electric cattle prod to drive us into corners where we cower for fear of being called terrorists or communists or criminals. How did we allow those who don't give a damn about how we, the 80%, live or die to rob us of our language, to intimidate us into cutting out our tongues and binding our limbs into lameness? How can we be more afraid to be called terrorists than to die in the dark with no one there to speak for us?
George Jackson. Well, I've heard it said that the darkest hour falls just before dawn. So I brace myself to my tasks, never doubting in my ability to struggle on. I feel no defeat could overcome me, and fear no evil but fear itself, perhaps. I've removed this emotion from my mind completely, and I languish in misery, waiting. This is a big part of the battle, waiting for the correct moment and then having the courage and wit to move when the time is right. The living condition, though bad, have no effect upon me physically. But how much longer will this last for me, in and out of prison? For you, in and out of debt? For the others of our kind who suffer jail, mental institutions, and the like? How long will we be forced to live this life where every meal is an accomplishment, where every movie or pair of shoes is a fulfillment, where a circumstance never allows our children to develop past a mental age of 16. I've been patient, but where I'm concerned, patience has its limits. Take it too far and it's cowardice.
And now our last reader of the evening, Hunter S. Thompson, reading the letter of application he once submitted to the Vancouver Sun in search of a job.
To Jack Scott, Vancouver Sun, October 1, 1958. Sir, I got a hell of a kick reading the piece Time magazine did this week on the Sun. In addition to wishing you the best of luck, I'd also like to offer my services. Since I haven't seen a copy of the new Sun yet, I'll have to make this a tentative offer. I stepped into a dunghole the last time I took a job with a paper I didn't know anything about. See enclosed clippings. And I'm not quite ready to go charging up another blind alley. By the time you get this letter, I'll have gotten hold of some of the recent issues of the Sun. Unless it looks totally worthless, I'll let my offer stand. And I don't think that my arrogance is unintentional. It's just that I'd rather offend you now than after I started working for you. I didn't make myself clear to the last man I worked for until after I took the job. It was as if the Marquis de Sade had suddenly found himself working for Billy Graham. The man despised me, of course, and I had nothing but contempt for him and everything he stood for. If you asked him, he'd tell you that I'm not very likable, that I hate people, just want to be left alone, and that I feel too superior to mingle with the average person. That's a direct quote from a memo he sent to the publisher. Nothing beats having good references. Of course, if you ask some of the other people I've worked for, you get a different set of answers. If you're interested enough to answer this letter, I'll be glad to furnish you with a list of references, including the lad I work for now. The enclosed clipping should give you a rough idea of who I am. It's a year old, however, and I've changed a bit since it was written. I've taken some writing courses from Columbia in my spare time, learned a hell of a lot about the newspaper business, and developed a healthy contempt for journalism as a profession. As far as I'm concerned, it's a damn shame that a field as potentially dynamic and vital as journalism should be overrun with dullards, bums, and hacks, hag-ridden with myopia, apathy, and complacence, and generally stuck in a bog of stagnant mediocrity. If this is what you're trying to get the Sun away from, then I think I'd like to work for you. Most of my experience has been in sports writing, but I can write everything from warmongering propaganda to learned book reviews. I can work 25 hours a day if necessary, live on any reasonable salary, and don't give a black damn for job security, office politics, or adverse public relations. I'd rather be on the dole than work for a paper I was ashamed of. It's a long way from here to British Columbia, but I think I'd enjoy the trip. If you think you could use me, drop me a line. If not, well, good luck anyway. Sincerely, Hunter S. Thompson.
This has been the National Press Club Hall of Fame Hour, sponsored by Wheaties, Lemon Pledge, Razor Wire Dental Floss, Lucky Strike Cigarettes, and Raid Underarm Deodorant, with guests Philip Berrigan, Daniel Berrigan, George Jackson, Marilyn Buck, Thomas Merton, and Hunter S. Thompson. Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown at the end of the empire. Duluth has big burritos and apricot wheat beer and a parade to celebrate cold weather. But Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings, like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops, and it's adventure, and it's being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling brawls, Bigfoot, and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the gold. We continue our story. We join Penny Jones and Fuff Dublin, driving out to the cabin property where Fuff had placed his Bigfoot recorder the other night. And rather than Bigfoot, he had heard people's voices, like someone being hurt or worse.
Gold, Fuff said as they got close. The white panel squeaked over the ruts and the wood chips. Penny Jones leaned close to the wheel and ducked at each branch that snapped the windshield. Fuff Dublin pulled on his new earring. He smoothed his ponytail, tugged his cap, and squinted to see through the growth on the path. Yesterday, he'd come in the other way, walking through the woods, parking the truck on the road. Season doesn't start for a week, Penny said. 10 days. Fuff had come out to the old stubble bean deer camp before to put out his recorder. He thought the outskirts of the camp, with Bigfoot coming in close to hear the men talking, would be as good a spot as any. Gold, Pup said, as Penny turned off the engine to coast to a stop to save gas. They arrived at the end of the path. Penny pulled into the little drive as far to the side as he could. He tried to get out his door, and it jammed against the tree. They both climbed out Fuff's door. Gold, said Fuff, as he found the ground. He felt his pants pocket for his compass and his belt for his bear spray. He smiled at Penny as Penny walked over to him. Hey, gold as in a great idea, a golden personality like that, right? That's what you mean, man, right? Said Fuff. Penny shook his head, walked past Fuff, kicking rocks ahead of him down the road. Fuff shuffled up to the gate and over toward the woods, pressing his feet to the ground like an invalid in slippers on the locked ward, not wanting to step out of his boots and not taking the time to lace them. This time they would be going in the front end past the cabin. If anyone was around, they would think of something to say to keep from getting shot. Penny looked all over and kept Fuff in sight. He ducked the branches and swam through, breaststroke. Fuff came to the clearing, the square cut, with the cabin smack dab up to the woods on the far side. He stopped to let Penny catch up. The front lawn area was strewn with wood chips. Red and yellow primary colors drew him out into the open. Fuff touched the used 12-gauge shells with the toe of his boot. A homemade sign leaned cockeyed on the ground against the house, red and white paint on plywood. Big, big game feast, $20 buffet, laser tag. Dude, Fuff whispered over his shoulder. Dude! Penny! Penny, still back away, smelled cedar smoke and looked up to see the plume zigging from the chimney. The cabin was a real cabin, old, run down, lived in, not like a lake cabin on the North Shore that was really a mansion. No vehicles outside, and the lean-to partially filled with loosely piled cedar. If someone came out, Fuff figured he would say, hey, what's Randolph doing? Just stop by to see if anyone was using this place for the season, if he had room for one more this year. He'd been here in high school as a guest of one of the Stupleton kids. His name was Randolph or Rudy, maybe Ron. An ancient wood chipper sat in the middle of the yard like a Greek finished fountain. Fuff slid a hand over the chipped metal, keeping his eyes on the house. He smelled oil and rubber somewhere running and jumping around with the wood smoke. Fuff put a hand on the old wood rail and a foot on the step. He pulled himself up to hang in the air to see in the front window through a slit in the moose curtains. He saw old stuffed chairs and end tables with cups and bottles and a wood stove and a hunting magazine and family photos on the wall. He let himself down to touch ground. Oh! Buck jerked his head around, back and forth. What was that? He said. Penny shrugged as he looked all around without moving his feet. Bigfoot, Fluff thought. They're known to make that noise sometimes, he'd heard. It can sound awful human. He moved his feet and became aware of the crunching leaves, the wind in his ears, the flap of a loose, the squeak, squeak of something in the woodpile. Ooh. Whoop. Fluff tried a homemade answer. Penny grabbed Fuff's arm. What are you doing? Fuff quick squatted to lace his boots. He got one done, and in the grass, he spotted a boot of the same type. Fuff looked at his old left boot, and that boot, and his ripped and retied laces, and sat down for a moment in the weeds to put the found boot bottom up to his own. He'd be walking around with one new boot and one old. He reached inside and snatched his arm back like a ghost had grabbed his hand. The boot was warm, sweaty. There'd been a foot in there not that very long ago. Penny followed right behind, looking all around, keeping a hand on his knife. Ooh, hey! Fuff shot from a sit to a squat, low to the ground, arms outstretched, a frightened man-tiger ninja. Hey, did that sound like hay? Fuff whispered to himself. Penny was still two steps behind. Hey! Staying in his squat, Fuff stepped over the dead boot. If he had a gun, it would be across his chest now. He put his clenched fist where a gun would be and crept around the corner. His recorder would be close to here, maybe. He thought he'd been near the cabin. Hoo-up! He tried again to speak Bigfoot. Hey! The return sound was lower, desperate-like and close. Fuff felt Penny right up on his back. Fuff put a hand on the cabin wall and pushed up to stand. He breathed hard. His chest poofed his flannel shirt out. In. Out. In. Fuff pulled down on the back of his turned-around ball cap, bringing it to his eyebrows. Penny followed suit with his stocking cap. Fuff looked down at his one untied shoe and stretched down toward it. Ah! He stood straight, his big brown eyes white. He stretched his left arm and placed his hand on the corner, his fingers out in the open, gripping as if he would ever have the courage to pull himself any further. At least he would make a show of it. At least he would make a show of it.
And that's the news from Duluth, where all the police and soldiers are thugs. All the Democrats and journalists are cowards. And all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up another New American Dream radio show. Once again, we apologize for the problems that we had, the technical issues, but we're glad that you were here to listen to us. And we hope you'll be back next week and each and every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. And thanks to our guests and potential guests, Phil Ferruggio, Michael Annis, Karen Kitkowski, and our thoughts go out to Mary Cowett, wife of Steve Cowett. Also, credit and thanks to Joe Badgett. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to the show.newamericandream.info. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. And as always, we wish to acknowledge the work of South Dakota stone artist Borglum Borglumson as he works to make over Mount Rushmore, put the real face of American history up there in stone. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sir Hans Rand, Mark David Chapman, and James Earl Ray. Follow the ongoing project at loserock.com, rollingstones.com, and jackrubyrubyrich.com. To help to support the show, please purchase one of our Tom Jefferson Rolling in His Grave Handy Campfire Rotisseries for the hobo in your family, or get one of our family-size Obamaville Tom Jefferson Rotisseries for the busy family on the move from town to town, woods to woods, made in Korea. And so good night to my friends, Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Salop. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Muhammad Atta. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.